Hello, everyone. Welcome to our The Week That Was in Euro podcast. My name is Dirk Schumacher. I'm the head of European macro research at Natixis. And with me, as usual, is Klaus Adam, professor of economics at the University of Mannheim.
Hello, everyone. So today we would like to discuss what economic costs are associated with permanently high inflation rates. This is an important question because bringing down inflation from the current high levels will most likely involve generating a recession. And the question is, what do we gain by doing so? Economic theory suggests that inflation affects economic outcomes along a number of channels, and we shall discuss today the quantitative importance of these channels and the empirical evidence that exists in their support. But before discussing the economic costs of permanently high inflation rates, let's have a look at the latest macro data coming out of Europe over the past week, Dirk.
Yeah, we have to start with data which are not released yet, which is the September PMI survey, which is a very good short-term gauge about activity. It comes out later today, but consensus expect a further decline. The question really seems to be now how deep the decline is, i.e., the recession most people expect. How deep is that going to be? And the PMI will give a first indication of that. What has been released and is also noteworthy are German producer prices for the month of July, and they surprised strongly to the upside. Given that producer prices have some leading in the characteristics over consumer prices, this does not bode well for consumer price inflation down the road. But now let's turn to inflation. Klaus?
Yeah, so there's obviously a long list of things in the economy that are affected by permanently high inflation rates. And we start going through them one by one, discussing their relevance and the support in the data, and then offer at the end a short summary of what we've learned. Importantly, we want to discuss today the economic effects of permanently high inflation rates and not the effects of inflation surprises. That is, inflation that turns out to be unexpectedly higher than previously thought. We had repeated positive inflation surprises in the past, meaning that actual inflation rates exceeded the forecasted ones, certainly over the past year. But what we are after here today is the effect of anticipated high inflation rates, a permanently high rate. And this is something that is relevant going forward, namely to assess what the gains are from bringing inflation down back to lower levels. So let's start with some of the classics, Dirk.
Yeah, perhaps the most classic argument against high inflation rates is due to Milton Friedman, Nobel Prize winning economist who worked at the University of Chicago some 60 years ago. Milton Friedman emphasized the fact that cash does not pay interest rates, and all is equal. When inflation is high, the nominal interest rates are high as well, because the average real interest rate is generally considered to be independent of the average rate of inflation. So higher inflation thus means higher nominal interest rates.
Yes, and higher nominal interest rates in turn imply that high inflation is associated with high costs of holding cash. And the reason is simple. Holding cash in times of high inflation means that then does not earn the high interest rates that are offered on other assets. And high inflation thus means higher costs of holding cash.
Yeah, and through this channel, high inflation causes people to reduce the demand for cash. And that's clearly something for which there is a lot of empirical support, especially in times of very high inflation. But even for lower rates of inflation, real cash demand is typically considered to fall with normal interest rates. And that's not a good thing in economic terms, because as society, we produce cash at virtually zero costs. After all, it's not socially desirable that households or any other economic agent economizes on holding cash. If everyone spends time on thinking how to optimize the cash holdings, there surely must be time lost for some productive activities. And again, in hyperinflation environments, that's very visible. And in fact, if cash is the preferred means of payment or the preferred store of value, then society should not tax these holdings by having inflation so as not to distort cash holding away from the socially optimal level.
Yes, and what's really interesting from a theory point of view is that that this result about not having inflation and thus not taxing cash continues to be true even if the government wants to raise revenue and even if it only has other distortionary means to do so available. So if it can only raise labor taxes that distort labor supply. And there's a general principle in optimal taxation theory. It's a very famous result, and it states that an optimal tax system does not levy taxes on the on intermediate inputs. It should only tax final goods. And in some sense, cash is only an intermediate input in purchasing final goods. And this means that the zero inflation result, in order not to distort cash holdings, is on theoretical grounds a very robust one.
Yeah, overall, this sort of argument is nice to make in theory, but really it described more the realities of the 1970s and the 1980s. Today's most common form of money is not cash, but electronic money. This, of course, depends on the country, but cash is really, in all advanced societies, only a small share of the existing money stock. Most money nowadays comes in the form of electronic money, and that can earn an interest rate at the same time as functioning as means of payment. And this implies that high rates of inflation no longer substantially increase the cost of holding means of payment. Inflation is probably less distortionary with regards to agents' desired liquidity holdings than that was the case in the past.
Yeah, that's most likely true. Now, let's now come to the next second most classic argument, so to say, against having high rates of inflation. And this is an argument that goes back to Martin Feldstein and others. Martin Feldstein was a professor at Harvard and for many years the president of the National Bureau of Economic Research. And he pointed out that inflation artificially increases taxes, where in fact real development suggests that no higher taxes would be warranted.
The leading example is the case where investors buy and sell real long-term assets, say commercial real estate or housing. And if the price of housing increases just because of inflation, then inflation produces nominal capital gains over time, even if in real terms, so adjusted for inflation, the investor has not gained anything. Given that we generally have capital gains taxes, higher inflation then increases the tax burden on real long-term assets, and through this reduces the incentives for investment in these assets. Inflation thus leads to an undersupply of real assets. That's the argument.
Yes, and similar effects are at play with wage income. If nominal wages rise in line with inflation and rise a lot because inflation is high, then real wages in terms of purchasing power have not increased. Yet, if there is a tax system that is progressive, that is where tax rates increase with nominal income, then we get that inflation increases the tax burden. And in economic terms, this is quantitatively important, given that many countries have a rather progressive tax system enshrined in their tax schedules.
Yes, but ultimately, this is an argument for low inflation. It's just one where one branch of government, i.e. the central bank, wants to prevent another branch of argument, the executive, to refrain from raising tax rates implicitly through this higher tax rates on the higher nominal income. If the executive were to index the tax schedule to take into account the inflation rate, then this argument in favor of low inflation rates would simply be gone. So what's the next on the list?
Yeah, what else we have? Well, the next thing that's on the list is nominal rigidities in prices and wages. That is to say, the fact that many prices in the economy do simply not adjust on a flexible basis. Wages, for instance, typically adjust only once per year, and many other prices, especially in services, remain nominally constant for considerable periods of time. Of course, some prices, like the price of gasoline, adjust all the time, but many consumer good prices remain constant for months, sometimes even years.
Inflation, however, erodes the real price of goods and services whose nominal price does not adjust. And if it is undesirable that the real price of goods and services falls, then inflation creates a misalignment of relative prices away from their optimal level. And these price misalignments in turn give rise to quantity misalignments that do not reflect economic fundamentals, but purely the fact that prices didn't adjust in time. So put differently, inflation blurs the price signal coming from real prices of goods and services. Given that the price signal is at the core of any market economy, one can see how high inflation weakens the very mechanism that makes a market economy thrive.
Yes, and this mechanism that inflation creates misalignment of prices and through it misalignment of demand is enshrined in virtually all modern monetary models currently entertained in central banks and also in many in academia. And in fact, this mechanism is in these models is the quantitatively overriding force for why inflation should remain low. And a case in point is my own research. For instance, we have just a paper that has been accepted for publication in the Journal of Monetary Economics that's titled The Case for a Positive Euro Area Inflation Rate, Evidence from France, Germany, and Italy, which I've written, amongst others, with my longstanding co-author Henning Weber from Deutsche Bundesbank. And in that paper, we quantify for the euro area, the model implied optimal inflation rate and the welfare costs of deviating from it due to price misalignments. And we really find that permanent inflation that lies significantly above or below a value of around 1.5% to 2% creates rather large welfare costs due to price misalignment. In fact, we compute that if you had a permanent inflation rate of around 4% in the euro area, this would lead to a loss that is equivalent to 0.1% of consumption every year. Given that the euro area consumption is around 6 trillion, the cost of permanently high inflation of 4% would thus be 6.6 billion euros each year, and even higher inflation rates create disproportionately larger losses. And these are only the costs associated with price misalignments. We don't compute the costs due to cash distortions or other things.
So while the mechanism that gives rise to this number comes from a standard monetary policy model, the question really is whether there is any empirical evidence in favor of the connection between inflation and price misalignments.
Yes, on this topic, the academic literature is really sparse. A notable exception is the paper titled The Elusive Costs of Inflation, Price Dispersion During the US Great Inflation, which was published 2018 in the Quarterly Journal of Economics and written by Amy Nakamura and John Steinson.
This paper looks at the cross-sectional dispersion of prices using the micro price data underlying the construction of the US CPI. They got their hand on the data since the late 1970s up until 2014. As is well known, inflation came down strongly over time during this period. And they show that the cross-sectional dispersion of prices steadily increased over time. So with some price movements between sectors despite inflation coming down. So when this sort of result implied that price dispersion does not behave the way predicted by economic models and that thus the cost of inflation may not be as high as generally believed, or to put it different, overall inflation coming down, but relative price movements going up, that's somewhat a contradiction to these models, it seems to me.
Yeah, so the paper by Nakamura and Steinson clearly raises an important empirical puzzle that at least in principle challenges the conventional wisdom enshrined in monetary policy models about the connection between inflation and inefficient price dispersion. But this said, you know, it's always a little more complicated than it seems. The paper really that these authors have written makes no attempt at distinguishing between efficient and inefficient price dispersion. Instead, it just looks at the raw dispersion of prices over time. And so really, it has nothing to say about the relationship between inflation and inefficient price dispersion that's postulated under the models. And that's key for generating welfare costs of inflation. And it's important to note that, say, the efficient dispersion of prices can move substantially over time. And this really could explain their empirical findings. For instance, it could be the case that in the data, price dispersion increases over long periods of time because the range of products becomes wider, and therefore more product differentiation within CPI categories generates larger dispersion of prices, and that could all be efficient. And this could mask the decrease in inefficient price dispersion that might have been triggered by the fall inflation rate over time.
Okay, that's interesting. So in this sense, there is, strictly speaking, no evidence in Nakamura-Steinson paper against standard source of welfare cost of inflation, if you make this distinction between, or take into account that the way to look at prices changes is not as clear as it might seem. But is there any evidence supporting the notion captured by monetary policy models that rising inflation leads indeed to more inefficient price dispersion?
Well, to date, there isn't. But I'm working on a paper with my co-author Henning Weber on precisely this topic using UK microprice data. And we overcome an important obstacle. We show how one can decompose raw price dispersion into a measure of efficient and inefficient dispersion. And we show that, as postulated by the models, the inefficient dispersion responds to deviation from its optimal level, precisely as predicted by the standard models. And I think these are quite interesting results. We have them together, but we need to write them up. And I think in a month from now, we will have a paper ready.
Hey, listeners, you heard it first. Next month, there's going to be a pathbreaking new paper being published. So it sounds clearly interesting and another podcast in the making, if you will. But at present, at least, is there really nothing around that would empirically support the notion that high inflation is associated with high welfare costs?
Well, there is a recent paper that speaks to this issue, even if it does not directly speak to the welfare costs being due to price dispersion. And the paper is somewhat ironically titled, "The Long-Run Phillips Curve is a Curve." And it's written by Guido Ascari and co-authors. So Guido was my former colleague at Oxford University, and he's currently head of monetary research at the Dutch Central Bank. So his paper estimates the relationship between long-run rate of inflation and the long-run level of output. And it documents that this long-run relationship is virtually not there for low inflation rates. That is, long-run output responds very little, if at all, to inflation for inflation rates that are low, something like below 4%, but then strongly starts to appear for inflation rates north of 4%. In fact, they estimate that above the 4% mark, any additional 1 percentage point increase of inflation causes an additional 1% of output loss. And that's, of course, a huge number, much more than some of the monetary policy models would generally imply, even though it's within the range of things that they predict.
So to sum up, it's not so straightforward as one would think, given that nobody really likes high inflation, to find empirical evidence whether the costs are really as high as, say, the theoretical models suggest, though the last paper class just mentioned seems to give some indication that the cost can be quite high. But in any case, there seems to be, food for further research, and Klaus is on the case, and that's good news, I guess. Thanks for your time again, Klaus. Speak to you next week.